Oh. I'm already crying. My name is Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here this weekend with all of you. And I am just getting teary looking around the room at people that I know, that I've met, people that I haven't met, and people that I feel like I know that I never even knew of. All my friends, all my people. I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to be here with you, and what an honor to be asked to be up here being one of the speakers. I don't know how that happened. I'm going to talk about steps 1 and 2. I'm going to take this jacket off. I'm already warm because I'm hot too. I still got it. That's right. Oh, that Amanda. Oh my gosh, that Sonia. And Lee. Lee put this on for us. Lee puts this conference on for us. I'm going to buy me a bunch of CDs this weekend. Yeah, I'm going to get like 4 sets of this weekend, because this weekend's going to rock. And then I'm going to get some historical ones too. Yeah, I'm going to send it to people who couldn't be here with us. Yeah. So I'm going to do step 1 and 2. Step 1, we're powerless over alcohol. And our lives become unmanageable. So my story, I was a barroom drinker. Any barroom drinkers in here? Anybody get barred from the bar? I started drinking in barrooms at a fairly young age. I was 16 years old. I was working in a nursing home, my first job. And the nurse I worked with used to take me with her to the barroom at the end of the shift. And I loved her. I got on that bar stool and I was more comfortable there than I'd ever been in my life. I felt more at ease on that bar stool than I felt in my own bed in my own home with my own family. I was at ease. I felt taller and prettier and blonder and smarter. I was all right there. And I really didn't feel all right anywhere else. Not like that. And then I wanted to feel like Dad all the time. I had parents. I had 3 brothers and 3 sisters. My dad was military. My dad was a good guy. My dad was an alcoholic. And so our family had alcoholic issues. But I was loved. I was loved. Not sure why I didn't feel that. I intellectually knew that I was loved. I was told I was loved all the time. Don't know why I couldn't feel that. That self-centeredness was with me long before I drank, that's for sure. So, the bar room, I was 16 years old on that bar stool. In high school, I remember one of my girlfriends saying to me, "How do you get away with drinking in the bar rooms every night? You know, you're not old enough." I think the drinking age was 21. I'm not really sure. I didn't pay any attention to it. And I said, "Well, you just act like you belong there. I mean, just come out of my... Where else did I belong? I didn't feel I belonged anywhere else. I didn't have to act. I belonged there. Where else does an alcoholic belong? Whether the bar stool is the couch in your living room or a bar stool in a bar room. That's where we belong. I belonged there until I found my seat in here. And then I found out where I belonged. In my seat in here. So I drank like that. I did somehow finish high school. I went to a community college. I used to, you know, you tell these lies. I told so many lies. And even in sobriety, I came to believe my own lies. And then it would, you know, I'm still clearing up. And for years I said, I went to this community college on a scholarship, you know. And then one day I go, wait a minute. I didn't have a scholarship. I had financial aid. You know, that's what I had. But it paid the bill at the school. But I couldn't show up there. See, I was carpooling with a couple of guys, and there was a pub on the way to the school. Allen's Pub. Anybody here from Massachusetts? Oh, good. So you'll interpret for the others if they miss anything. So I was going to the community college up in Gardner, Massachusetts. I was living in Aya. That's North Worcester County. It's not Boston, okay? That's all I'm going to say about that. But I was carpooling with these guys. We go by Allen's Pub. I said, hey, let me off here. I don't have a class till 11. And they said, are you sure? I said, of course I'm sure. I was never more sure of anything in my life. So, you know, I didn't make it to many classes. And then they'd come back around at the end of their day to pick me up, say, we're going to give you a ride home. And I'd say, I'll take the bus. Well, there's no bus in Gardner, Massachusetts. I think there was a Greyhound that went every 3 or 4 days, taking the prisoners back, the ones that got out. They take them back to the, you know, wherever they came from. There was a big maximum security up there in Gardner, Massachusetts. But there was no regular bus. But that was another lie, because I didn't want to leave the bar yet. It was only 4 o'clock. I couldn't get off of that bar stool at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I was just getting started. I'd only been there since 8 in the morning. It's early, yes. I couldn't get off. Anybody else not able to get off the stool? I couldn't. It was like my ass was glued there. I wasn't going anywhere. I didn't know what that was. I thought I was all right. Well, after, you know, a few times of having to figure out how to get home after the bar closed, I just stopped going. Because it was easier to drink at the bar near my house. And I got a triangle out there. We got a triangle in here. Well, I had a triangle out there. It was the bar I drank in, the diner I worked in, in the apartment I slept in. My world got very small. And I liked it. I could walk the triangle or stagger, whatever. And I had this big Pontiac Le Mans, the big V8 in it, gas hog. That's what I used to call it, your gas hog, running out of gas. It always wanted something, tires, oil, registration, driver's license. It never ended. that Pontiac. I said, you know, I can walk this triangle. I took that thing up in the woods and I left it there. What a relief. I was so happy that day, dancing all the way out of the woods back down to the bar room. You know, that was too much responsibility, that Pontiac. Never ended. I needed my money. Couldn't spend it on that Pontiac. And I walked away from it just the same way I had walked away from my family, and just the way I walked away from my education. I just wanted to be in that barroom. And I could no longer punch that. When you're at work in the nursing home, I was a nurse's aide, you had to punch the clock at a certain time. You know, that got really difficult. And they don't like it when you don't do it right. I was always on the carpet. So I said, I can't do it anymore. And I really, you know, I was a functional alcoholic for about 3 weeks. I just couldn't. So I started waitressing that diner. I said, well, this works better. I'm going to do 5 or 6 hours, fill my pockets up with money, and walk over to the bar. That was great. I was living a day at a time. You see, I was powerless. Alcohol was my higher power. I was powerless over alcohol. Alcohol was my higher power. I did whatever. And I didn't even mind. No, I didn't mind. I was happy to do it. Thought everything was okay. Now, around this time, sisters, brothers getting married, having showers and baby showers and things. And I'd not be able to get off the stool to go. I'd say I was going to go. And I'd have every intention of going. And I actually wanted to go for some of them. Some of my siblings I liked. I wanted to go. And I couldn't. I just couldn't. And I'd say to the bartender, if anybody calls for me, I'm not here. Nobody called. You know what I mean? Nobody ever called. My family knew where I was. Yeah. So it would bother me a little bit now and again. But not that bad. I drank in the neighborhood barroom with Eddie and Louie. Two old guys. We watched reruns of Hogan's Heroes. We watched Vanna White turning the letters. We guessed the words. I thought I was getting a great education from those two old bums. Eddie had a beagle he kept out in the car. I'd run a Slim Jim out every couple of hours, keep the dog alive. And Louis had a girlfriend that come in once a month and beat him up and take his check. And we just tan back because she was tough. We didn't want to get hurt. And then we'd help him back up on the stool. Dust him off, you know. These were my friends. And one day Eddie came out of a blackout. He said, what are you doing here with us all the time? You're here with us all the time. You're young. You have your whole life ahead of you. Oh, I was crushed when he said that to me. See, I didn't fit anywhere else. I fit there with them guys. I felt okay there. I didn't feel that way anywhere else. And I didn't have an answer for him. I didn't know why. But, so, you know, what happened to me happens, I think, a lot of times. I don't know if it's dating when you're leaving together at the end of the night. Not sure if that's courtship. Don't really know. But this guy from the neighborhood started coming in that bar room. And I started leaving with him at the end of the night. The next thing, that's a couple, actually. You're a couple. He's wooing you. And you know, what happened was I turned up pregnant. That's how they say it in my family. She turned up pregnant. You know, like she turned up a pancake flipped over. I never quite understood that saying. She turned up pregnant. So I didn't tell them. I didn't go to my family. I didn't know what to do. This guy that I was a couple with, he was actually not a bad guy. He had a good job. He had a car. That's why I left with him at the end of the night. Got a ride. And I didn't have a car, right? So, and I didn't have a job anymore. I couldn't hold a job anymore. That was hard. So, he thought the right thing to do was to get married, have a family, do the right thing. He had a moral compass. However, I didn't know what the right thing would be. I was really not sure. So I asked Eddie and Louie. What should I do? They said, marry him. He has a job. That was their criteria. They said, we'd marry him if we could. He has a job. Sad, right? That's not what I was dreaming of when I was a little girl in school. You're dreaming about your wedding day and the prince, you know. That's not how it's supposed to go. How about that game, the dating game? You open the door. Remember that? You got the dud. You know. Remember all that silly game? I think they did away with it. It was a sexist game. So I, you know, here we were. And he said his job was going to send him to Copenhagen, Denmark to work. And so we got on a plane and we went there. And on that plane, we talked about how we were going to be good parents. He had good parents. I had good parents. Not without problems, but we had good parents. We talked about how we were going to be good parents. We were going to change. It was exciting. He was about 10 or 11 years older than me. He was. But, We We were doomed. We were drunks. He's in recovery himself, so I can say that. We were alcoholics. It wasn't going to be pretty. But we didn't know that. We were powerless over alcohol. But we didn't know that. We had the same dream of any other person who's going to have a baby, right? But that wasn't how it was going to be for us. So we got to Denmark, and he went to work, and I went to the nearest bar room. I didn't. What else would I have done? Of course, that's what I did. So I went to the nearest bar room. I met some Danish, Eddie and Louie. I started sitting there with them every day. They didn't even speak English. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. They spoke my language. We sit here all day and we drink. That was my language. So, now, this is the painful part of my story to tell. I don't even always want to tell it. Somehow I feel a little more at ease telling it here with all women. You see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard a lot of women say that they stopped drinking for 9 months. And then they had their baby, and then they drank. Well, that wasn't my story. I couldn't stop drinking. I tried to stop drinking. I wanted to stop drinking during that time. Of course. And I couldn't. So I never shared that for a long time in these rooms. And I know people talk about it, because I've heard them talk about it now. But 36 years ago, in small towns, Massachusetts, I didn't hear it there. And unfortunately, I didn't go to a lot of other places where I might have heard it. So I held it in. I was never going to tell anybody. I was so ashamed. And I thought, if I told you, I wouldn't be allowed here. And nobody would, my sponsor loved me. Well, clearly she wouldn't if I ever told her that. So I drank in that bar room in Denmark, and I concealed that pregnancy. I wore big clothes and stuff. And one day, they realized I was pregnant. And they cast me out of that bar room. And they called me names. And I agreed with them. I agreed with them. That is how I felt about myself. I knew they were right. I was scum. And I left the bar room that day. I was more determined than ever, never to drink. I wasn't going to drink. I knew they were right. And the next day I was down in the cellar with a jug of wine by myself, crying, saying, I'm not going to do this tomorrow. I just got to do it today to take the edge off. But tomorrow I'm not going to do it. Be all done. Tomorrow. I had no idea what was wrong with me. I just kept thinking I was such a bad person. See, in my family, being married and having children is the most honorable job a woman could have. And here I was, in the cellar with a jug of wine. Just felt I was such a loser. So bad. And I felt I was hurting my baby. The horrors, I mean, that's when the horrors of alcoholism really set in for me. The loneliness, the self-loathing, the bewilderment. What's wrong with me? The devil's got me. I thought the devil had me. Then I thought I had twins inside of me, a good one and a bad one, and the bad one was winning. You know, you get a little psychotic too, get delusional, spend so much time alone thinking about yourself, drinking. It's terrible, terrible, terrible place to be mentally. Powerless over alcohol. So, you know, the day came when I had to go to the hospital, give birth. They say that like it's nothing. Go give birth. You go give birth. I'll give blood. I don't want to give birth. Jeez. And I was terrified. Oh, I was so scared. I thought, this baby's going to be born with all kinds of problems. And that's my fault. That's my fault, and everyone's going to know it's my fault. Oh, the horror. So we go to the hospital, and I lock myself in the bathroom in the hospital, and I'm never coming out. And I'd still be there today if I could. But you know it hurts. It hurt a lot. And I come running out of there. Help me, help me. And the midwife looked at me and she said, I bet this is the first time in your life you couldn't walk away from something you didn't like. I said, how does she know me? How does she know me? We've only just met. Well, you know, they took over. They did everything. I wasn't any help, I'm sure. We're supposed to help them. I didn't help them. I didn't know what to do. I was terrified. I was 20. I was 20 years old. So, in that now, I got to tell you this part. By this time in my life, and since an early age, I stopped believing in God. You see, my faith went out the window. I was about 8 years old. I didn't believe in anything. So that's how I entered that delivery room. But that's not how I come out of there. In that delivery room, they handed me this newborn child. And his eyes were open. And he was perfect. And I looked in his eyes, and I saw God for the very first time. And I'm not saying to you that God wasn't there before that. I'm saying that's the first time I recognized him. And I fell in love. I fell in love with that child. And in that moment, I knew I will be the best mother to this child. He will want for nothing. I will care for him like gold. And I meant it. And we went home from the hospital. And he went to work. And I went down in the cellar with a jug of wine and that newborn. And the horrors of alcoholism just multiplied. I did not know what was wrong with me. And I did not know there was any way out. that we came home, back to the States, back to Massachusetts. And I went back to the bar rooms that I'd always been in before. And now I was finding babysitters and making up excuses. It was terrible. My son's father sent me to a psychiatrist. Boy, we can have a lot of fun with them. Are there any in the room? I mean, they don't know what to make of us, unless they're familiar. Many of them are familiar, especially nowadays, so they can see through it, but back then. But actually, the one I had, I think he could, but I don't know. I got a diagnosis of Valium deficiency. I mean, that's the best diagnosis I ever got. Because you get these Valiums, you got to take them. You don't have enough. Very nervous and shaky. So I'm taking these Valiums. Of course, he told me not to drink on them, but I didn't hear that. Down the bar room, taking these. Now, people didn't, you know, you had your friends, they don't want to drink with you anymore. Eddie, Louie, other, you know, things change. But I had this one girlfriend, she'd still drink with me. And she had those Valiums too. She had the same nervous disorder, I guess. So we'd take those Valiums and we'd drink. We were very calm drunks. Very relaxed. We didn't have any fights. We had these big pocketbooks we carried around. Bunch of stuff in there. Clothes, you know, whatever, clothing, extra stuff. Bottles, pills. So one day I said, "What do you carry that blow dryer around in your pocketbook for?" She had a full-on blow dryer in there. She says, "Well, when I pee my pants, it's easy. I can just go in the ladies' room, plug it in, dry everything up. I don't have to carry around so much clean laundry." Well, I said, "Geez, I'm glad I'm not that bad." You know how we do that. Until I peed my pants. And then I thought, she's a genius. I'm so glad she's my friend. I wouldn't have thought of that on my own. Blow dryer. Yeah, it was very glamorous. Yeah. What? I never got any better. See, my drinking, my alcoholism, it was like an elevator going down. You know, I never got any better. I kept getting, and then I'd lower the standard, my own standard. I'd lower it so that it matched what I was doing. So that was me and Vandy. Yeah. So what happened? I thought, I got to stop drinking. I mean, really, I wanted to stop drinking. I just wanted it all to stop. The pain, the misery, the babysitters. The peel in my, you know, when they can hold your leg and cry, and I'm peeling them off of my leg, and I'm saying, "Mama's going to come right back. I'm going to come right back." And he knew I was lying, and I knew I was lying, and I had to go, and I'd walk away from him. And I'd be crying. I didn't want to walk away from him. I had to walk away from him. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol. I thought I was a terrible person and a terrible mother. And I couldn't tell anybody what was happening. I couldn't tell anybody. So lonely. So I thought, okay, it's the marriage. That's what's caused all these problems. So I left the marital home. I took a Buick that had a loan on it. I took a laundry basket full of clothes, and I took that baby. He was 2 years old, and we left. When driving away, I thought, everything's going to be okay now. I really believed it. I was 22 years old. Everything's going to be all right. It was the marriage. It was him. I just had to get away from him. And then I found myself drunk and drunk, drunk and drunk. I was shocked. I was actually shocked by that. I was so sure that I had the answer. So I said, all right, it's the waitressing. It's the waitressing. Why didn't I think of it before? So I get a job. I said, I got to have a job with a desk. I got to have a desk. People with a desk, they don't drink. They pack a lunch. They have a normal life. I got to have a desk. So I go all over town. I'm pleading, applying for jobs I am never going to be qualified for. And making up qualifications. And I end up getting a job with a desk as a customer service representative at a cable television company. And I had a computer on my desk that I said I knew how to use. I'd never even seen a computer in my life. There was a phone with, I don't know, 40 buttons. Never seen one before. But I lied. So I'm sitting at this desk, and I'm drinking. And I don't understand. So what happened? So I have been called into back rooms many times. I have been thrown out of many places by then. I had been fired from my two previous waitressing jobs because of the way I smelled. And one day the boss calls me in the back room from my desk. And I don't know what's going to happen. I'm hoping he's going to make a pass and I'll be his girlfriend. Or maybe he's going to give me a promotion. But I'm always game, so I go in the back room with him. Maybe he's got cocaine, you know. Back rooms are good for that too, right? So I go in the back room, all optimistic. But what happened was, he goes, see this computer back here? I said, I could handle it, sure. I can do it. He goes, no, this computer monitors all the calls that come into this office. And you haven't been getting any. Who have you been talking to? Well, I was only pretending to be on the phone. I was pushing a button and talking to a pretend person. I was never going to talk to a real person on that phone. So I thought, oh God, I'm caught. I got caught all the time, different stuff. So I said, let me just get my purse. That was always my line. You know, I wasn't a fighter, a beggar, nothing. Let me just get my purse, I'm out of here. I don't want to get beat up. He said, no. He said, and then he proceeded to tell me his story. I know. He knew what was wrong with me. He knew. I didn't know. He told me that he had 3 children he couldn't see unless he was supervised by the state of Massachusetts. And he had a broken marriage and a broken home and broken furniture. And then he had drank and drugged himself into the ends of the earth. But now he had 2 years without a drink or a drug. He's standing there in a pair of chinos and a polo shirt. I can't even picture him, what he's saying to me. I had no idea why he was telling me this. But I was awfully glad he was confiding in me. And my mind was already calculating, oh, thank goodness, he's my friend. He's confiding in me. I won't have to worry about getting here on time in the morning. That's been so hard. And coming back from lunch, that's torture. Why do they even give us lunch? I can't make it back after lunch. Why don't we just work through lunch, leave early? You know, you leave the lunch, you go to a bar room, you can't get up. You can't get out of there. So I thought he wanted my advice. And I said, I'm so glad you told me this. Got it off your chest. Now you can take it to your grave. You never have to tell anyone else. And I won't tell the other ladies that work here. And he's looking at me. And he goes, do you know you have 2 different shoes on today? I just didn't know what to do then. If I should look down or run for my car. And I said, are you going to fire me? He said, no, you don't have to leave. I was so shocked by that. I was so used to getting thrown out. He goes, no, you don't have to leave. He said, I'm going to teach you how to use that computer and that phone. And if you ever think that you might have a problem with alcohol, I know some people. They helped me, and I think they could help you too. He never said Alcoholics Anonymous. He never told me it was you. He just said some people. So I went to my desk and he showed me how to use this stuff. And I was trying to do better, but I couldn't stop drinking. About 6 weeks later, I come into work on a Tuesday. I couldn't make it on Monday. His name was Joe. I said, "Joe, take me to your people." And at that point, I had an eviction notice on the apartment door. I had no electricity in that apartment, no food, no phone. And I could no longer look my little son in the eyes anymore. I couldn't bear it. I was looking at the car that I was hiding from the repossession people, and I was trying to figure out how we were going to live in that car. That's where my life was when I finally asked Joe for help. See, that guy, can you imagine the good that we do in this world by telling our stories, whether we're telling them here, or we're telling them at work privately, or we're telling them on a bus, or we're telling them in a Uber or at an airport. When we see it, if we got somebody with a willing ear, yeah, we save lives. We're the only ones who can do it, right? We're the only ones who can do it. I wouldn't. I had people telling me I drank too much from I was 15 years old. That all started. He didn't say that to me. He said he drank too much. Such a different message. So he said, "Can you not drink the rest of today and go to this place tonight?" He wrote it on a paper. He wrote the name of a church and the address, and he wrote Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm looking at the paper. I said, "Yeah, I can. I'll do it. And then I'm thinking about it, and I'm saying, it's in a church. They're never going to let me in a church. I'll never get in. Not the things I've done, they're not going to let me in." So, but I said, it says Alcoholics Anonymous. "Oh, we wear a disguise. That's how we get in the church." So I went home and I put on a disguise. I put on my best Salvation Army dress, a big straw hat with a big red bow on it, big jacket on that, the sunglasses, two shoes that matched. And I drove that Buick on fumes to that meeting. And I'm out in the parking lot there, smoking, because no matter how broke you are, you can get cigarettes, right? I always did. I'm out there smoking. And I'm watching these people go in the church, and they don't appear to be in disguise, only I. But I'm out there and going, am I really going to go in this place? And then it just kind of came over me, like, no matter what's going to happen to me in there, it can't be any worse than what's happening to me out here. And I got all the courage I had left in the world, and I walked up into that church. And I sat way in the back of the room. And I looked around, I said, these people don't look like they drink like I do, and drink in the places I do. They look all clean, and they got teeth. unusual. Then they had a break in the middle of the meeting. They had a break. And a guy went up and got a cup of coffee. And I recognized him from the bar room. And I approached, after the meeting, I marched over to him. His name was Peter. I said, "Peter, what's going on here?" I demanded to know. Because Peter looked totally different. Peter had eyes and teeth. He never had any of that. Clean shirt. I'm there. What happened to Peter? So he looks, he goes, "Who are you?" So I briefly lifted my disguise. I said, "Peter, it's me, Diana." He goes, "We've been waiting for you." I said, "You have?" He said, "Oh yeah, saving a seat." And then he started to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Started to explain to me. He goes, "This is where we go on Tuesday nights. Tomorrow I'll take you where we go on Wednesday nights." He goes, "That's Irish Pat, that's Zeus." Telling me all. And as he's standing there, I'm looking into his eyes. And I see that same look, that same thing that I saw in my son's eyes when he was born. I saw the love of God. I saw love, kindness, compassion. And I recognized it. I said, "What is that?" I didn't know to call it the love of God then. I didn't know what it was, but I liked it. I liked it. I said, "There's something going on. You've got a light in his eyes. Peter." "Well, I've since learned it's the love of God. That's what I see in your eyes here right now. That's what I see right now. You betcha. That's what we're spreading around. The love of God. It comes from inside of us." In the passage that Christy was so kind enough to read for me, "Within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God within us, shining the sunlight of the Spirit." Well, our eyes are the perfect light. I hope you see it in my eyes. Good. It's all I ever wanted. From the first time I saw it, I said, "What is it? What's going on?" I didn't even know to ask the question. For a time, it took me time. I'm in the slow class. I'm in the slow class in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very much so. Yeah. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I knew I was insane when I drank. I could see that. Took me time to see that it happened to me when I wasn't drinking. So, when I was first new, I started to steal food from the meetings right away because I didn't have any food. Didn't have any electricity to keep the food. So the meetings often have food, as you know. Yeah. Not cookies. I'd steal anything. I had my big pocketbook. And this lady caught me stealing from the meeting the food. Cookies and an apple. I had a 2-year-old. So I told her the truth. She said, "What are you doing that for?" I said, "I have a little boy, and I don't have any food." I didn't want to be honest, but I was. I don't even know why, because I was a really good liar. But She said, "See that pudgy guy in the back of the room? Big belly?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Go tell him you don't have any food." I thought, "Oh, he probably owns a restaurant or a grocery store. He's going to give me some vouchers." So I went and told him. Well, he was John T. from Boston, Massachusetts. He was an old bachelor. And he drove around the state. He'd go to every meeting where they had the anniversary meeting, the group anniversary. He had them all marked in a calendar, the old paper ones. Had them all in there. So he took that calendar out. He says, "Oh, tomorrow night, come over to Clinton, the Friday night group at St. Patrick's." And when they ask for volunteers to help clean up after the meeting, raise your hand. I'm thinking, this is such a puzzle. Looking around so confused by all these secret messages. So, I said, "Well, what? All right. You know." So I go, and I raise my hand to help clean up. Well, they filled my trunk with leftover salads and meat trays and breads. And I followed John T. for a year. I fed my son for a year, following John T. around, trying to catch up on my car payments and catch up on my rent. John T., there was always a crowd of us following him, the hungry ones. I didn't know I was being fed spiritually. I didn't know that bread, the daily bread, the food, I didn't know. Yeah, we get spiritually fed in here. I've gotten everything I've ever needed here. More than I could have ever dreamed of. Faith. My faith is so strong now. You know, powerless. Powerless over alcohol. Yes. Well, let me tell you about Martha. I met Martha when I had a year of sobriety. She was my sponsor for the next 18 years till she passed away. And she changed my life. She helped me change who I was. She'd tell me, "The woman you brought to this program will drink again. You must change." And I'd say, I was so terrified of drinking again. "Okay, what do I do?" You know, terrified to drink again. I became a sober mother to my child. That wasn't going to happen. Not without you. Not without this program. Not without good sponsorship. My son had a sober mother. I was a sober daughter, a sober friend, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober employee. Martha sent me back to school. I couldn't make a living, you know. She said, "Did you ever want to be anything? You know, I just want to be sober, Martha." She said, "No, did you ever want to be anything? You know, when you grew up." I said, "Well, you know, I did want to be a nurse, but I'm not smart enough. I'm not pretty enough." She said, "Is that what they told you when you went down to apply?" "Apply? What do you mean?" So she She goes, go get the forms at the school. Go get the forms. So we filled out some forms, and I got accepted to a nursing school. And I went. And I became a registered nurse, and I was able much better to provide for my son. A lot of nurses here? I bet we got a lot of nurses in here. How many nurses? You all got to get hugs. Hugs for the nurses! Oh, Lord. I did that for 15 years. Then I said, Martha, I'm tired. It's hard work. She said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to go to law school, kick some ass. She said, go get the forms. So I did. Filled out some forms. I went to law school in Boston. Yeah, it was wonderful. I'm so grateful I had, because I couldn't be a nurse now. My health has changed. I couldn't do it. It was hard like 15 years ago. I can't even imagine. But I love nurses. I was a nurse first. Now I'm a lawyer. I got a desk again. Sitting at my desk. I got to pinch myself. I say, am I really a lawyer? How could it be possible? Anything is possible. Martha said, we live our dreams in Alcoholics Anonymous. We live our dreams. Whatever our dreams are, we can live them here. Oh, she was wonderful. I had, you know, the insanity, though. To be restored to sanity, you got to recognize that you're not sane. And in sobriety, I haven't always had that luxury. Had a few times when, you know, it's like walking around with an apple on your head. Everybody else can see it, but you can't. You're out of your mind and you don't know it. You think you're all right. I mean, I was going to that nursing school. And working part-time, going to school, dragging that kid everywhere, living in two rooms, struggling all the time, broke all the time. Todd, no doubt about it, even with all the support, you know. But I always had this fantasy that I would meet a bank robber from Charlestown, and we would be bank robbers together. The secret fantasy. I always watch bank robber movies. Well, one day, you know, when you're in AA, you go with the group on all the commitments. You go to the detoxes. Well, you go to the prisons, too. Well, then when the guys get out of the prison, they come to your group. Sometimes it works out. Other times, well, this guy came to our group from the prison. I'd met him when we went there. He was very cute. I said, what were you in for? He says, I'm a bank robber. Really? I said, where are you from? He says, Charlestown. Well, I just about melted. My heart was pounding. I said, this is God's will. God doesn't want me struggling with all this school and work. He wants me to have an easier life. Bank robbing. It's always been my dream. Martha says we live our dreams. And he's so cute. So we're making eyes at each other, moving from the front. row further back, you know, so we can talk. He says, you'd make a good bank robber. I said, you know, I always thought I would. He says, they never suspect a woman. We wear all black and black hats. Even if it's on the camera, they'd never know if you were a female. I'm there, well, that's pretty good. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we're going on like this. And I thought, I better tell Martha. I don't want to tell her, but maybe I should. I call her up. I said, Martha, I met this really nice guy. I tell her the whole story. She goes, run that by me again. I tell her the whole thing again. She goes, one more time. About the third time I'm telling her, I finally hear it. Finally heard the insanity. I'm there, oh, jeez. She says, listen. He just got out of prison for bank robbing, right? I said, yeah. She says, well, then he's not that good at it. She says, if you're going to go with a bank robber, go with a good one. Okay. You know, these sponsors got a lot of wisdom. She says, now get back up in the front row. Don't talk to him anymore. Just stay away from him. So I did. I got back up in the front row. And he started talking to another girl in the group. I was heartbroken. Devastated, crushed. How can he be paying attention to her? And they ran off together, robbing banks. And then off to prison. And it could have been me. Close call. Could have been me. See, the apple's on the head, but you can't always see it. You gotta run it by somebody. It's like getting checked for fleas. You're like, do I have any? Do I have any fleas? You can't see them yourself. You gotta get help. Someone has to check you. 10 minutes? Yeah. So I can give you a million examples of that. Insane in sobriety. So I have to have a real good sponsor. I have to have a sponsor that'll say to me, you look fat in those pants. Go change. I have to have it. Martha was like that. Thank God. Because I can't take the beating around the bush. You got to tell me. It's the only way I could hear it. My sponsor now, Barbara. She was going to be here, but she couldn't make it, so. Oh, Barbara, she's from Boston. Yeah. She tells me. Yeah. But I need it that way. So what happened, I want to talk a little bit about powerlessness in terms of, because my powerlessness is over many things. I found that out over time. Oh, it's one thing after another. It's a powerlessness. But then I always got the higher power. So I always got the answer. See, it's so different. Because now I got the answer. The higher power. It's not powerless. So I keep looking at Angie because my son, when he was 18 years old, maybe younger, but by the time I caught on, he was about 18. And he got on the drugs. And he got on, you know, heroin and God knows what else. And I thought that was my fault. I thought if I had been better and, you know, wasn't supposed to happen. See, I thought I was breaking the cycle. How come? Wasn't I breaking the cycle? And I had to come through a whole nother part of understanding again the disease of alcoholism, the illness. How could I break a cycle on an illness? Makes no sense, right? I had to be put in Al-Anon. My AA friends put me in Al-Anon. I was out of my mind. I was going to some projects looking for my son at 2 and 3 in the morning by myself, banging on doors. My son in there. I could have got myself killed. But I was so insane, so worried, so scared. And for years, that's why I moved to Florida. I had to leave Massachusetts. I couldn't watch it happen to him anymore. And I couldn't help him. But I met people like Angie who helped me to keep loving him, to keep the communication open, to not write him checks. And the powerlessness. I would have stood in front of a train to keep that disease, this disease, from happening to him. So, my son has 10 months. I've been up to Massachusetts 3 times to see him in the last 10 months. We're so close now. He's home and he tells me and we talk and he loves me and I love him. And he's in, he's completely in the NA program. He went to treatment, he went to a halfway house, he went to a three-quarter. He just moved down to an apartment upstairs from his sponsor. He's on this committee, he's speaking at the detox, he's going to the conferences. He's loving it, he loves it. He's happy. He's free. He's free. He's 38 years old. For 20 years, I envied other people when they would say their son or their daughter, no matter what they did, they made a bologna sandwich. I'd go, I hate you. Your son made a bologna sandwich. I hate you. It hurt so much. I was so scared all the time. What do I have to complain about? My life, what a gift. My faith, what a gift. In this room, you people, what a gift. I've just never been happier. Like everything is okay. Everything is okay. then everything was okay. I just didn't know it. I had to trust. You have to have Alan on if that's going on. I mean, I don't think I'd be sober today if I hadn't had Alan. If my AA friends hadn't put me in the Al-Anon and left me there. So, I know I only have probably no time left. 3 minutes. So I live on the Gulf of Mexico. I got a little law office with a couple employees that I adore. I have a man in my life that I adore, that adores me. Dad, 10 years we've been together. We met on Christmas Eve in the detox. It's so romantic. You know, it's dark in there. It's kind of like candlelight. But we were the speakers. We were carrying the message on a Christmas Eve in a detox near the Gulf of Mexico. That's how we met. Yeah, it's a beautiful life. It's a beautiful life we have. For anybody who's new, who's just trying to figure out what's going on here, you don't have to figure it out. It's just going to happen to you. Everything is okay. Everything is okay. You're in the right place. This is the place to be. Right here, right now, with all of us. Thank you so much.